This week on Making Contact.
If you don't have education or you've been to prison, entrepreneurship is the only way for people to sort of lift themselves out of poverty.
Unemployment teeters on the double digits, and long-term joblessness is at an all-time high. When will relief come to those who need a paycheck?
On this edition of our series, How We Survive, we look at how the unemployed are getting creative about making ends meet, from starting their own businesses to work sharing.
We, thankfully haven't been in this situation since the Depression, but we really have to, I think, look to do things we might not otherwise do.
Everyone saw the turndown of the business. It just made everybody work together as a team.
I'm Pauline Bartoloni.
And I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
In the winter of 2009, President Obama vowed to take action to end what was quickly becoming an unemployment crisis in the U.S. He signed into law a stimulus plan, which created a lot of buzz around green jobs. Some green jobs have been created, but perhaps not as quickly as desired, says Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. We asked Baker what ideas he has for creating jobs.
I would say, at least in some areas, we certainly want to have public sector jobs to get people, give them something to do, give them a paycheck, give them a start in life. Some other things, we do have infrastructure needs. The Obama administration has made some steps that way, but I think there's a lot more. There's a big backlog of infrastructure. But the long and short, I think the best way to deal with unemployment is this work share idea. Let's allow people to work fewer hours, and I think that takes care of the immediate problem.
We'll have more about shared work programs, public sector jobs, and we'll talk to Dean Baker again later on in the show.
Meanwhile, we'll take a look at job creation efforts that aren't so top-down, micro-enterprises. The Obama administration calls small businesses the engines of private sector job growth. And Obama himself expressed his support of small businesses at a visit to a New Jersey sub shop in July of 2010.
Small businesses create 2 out of every 3 jobs in this country, so our recovery depends on them. And if we want to keep America moving forward, we need to keep investing in our small businesses.
But despite Obama's words of support of small business, experts say some aren't relying on government, but more and more on community groups and micro-lenders. That's what Making Contact correspondent Lee Miao Lovett found, talking to micro-entrepreneurs in the San Francisco Bay Area.
At this farmer's market in the foggy southern tip of San Francisco, a girl band entertains the lunch crowd, while vendors sell everything from heirloom tomatoes to ethnic food. One booth has a line of customers for pulled pork sandwiches and tacos.
Folks, have any questions on the menu there?
That's Dante Ball. He prepares the pulled pork in a 3-day braising and smoking process. He's a San Francisco native who grew up on farmers market food. Several years ago, at the age of 19, he ventured onto the streets with his sandwiches.
I sold 2 sandwiches, and like 3 minutes later, I had a line like outside, and the local bar owner was like, "Hey, when you coming back?"
You gotta have a sandwich with the slaw, man. It takes it to the next level.
At the same time, Ball continued to work at restaurants, honing his cooking skills. He took the leap to start Good Foods Catering in May 2009, right before the engines of financial lending had ground to a halt.
I have so much creativity and so many ideas that they need to be pushed out and people need to have them. So I was like, I'm definitely going to go the business route. Recession to me means opportunity. It means opportunity for smaller micro purveyors.
Amidst the bustle of activity here on a Sunday morning, you wouldn't know that the country has been in a recession with almost 7.5 million jobs lost. While unemployment ranks have swelled, some have turned to generating income on their own by starting small businesses that may or may not be on the radar. California is the leading state in microenterprise, businesses employing less than 5 people. Defying the naysayers, entrepreneurs like Ball have persisted despite the tide of bad economic news. Robin Fountain is program coordinator at Renaissance Entrepreneurship Center. where she has coached Ball in managing his business.
That sort of mobile aspect of his business has enabled him to be successful in this economy where it doesn't sort of work very well to open up your own brick and mortar business at the time.
Ball needed a formal office for meetings as well as help with bookkeeping. That's where Renaissance provided the resources. Since launching his catering business, Ball has had to obtain permits for each of the four farmers markets where he operates and comply with city ordinances and laws for handling food. Fountain works with residents of Bayview Hunters Point, a community of mostly African American and low-income folks. Lots of people here don't have access to credit or lack the credit scores and business experience required for a traditional bank loan. While Dante Ball might be a born businessman, Fountain says many people have turned to entrepreneurship since the downturn in the economy. In the last 2 years, she's seen a doubling in the number of clients served by Renaissance.
One of the things that's happening in this recession is that large banks are not lending credit anymore, which I think it seems like it's disproportionately affecting small business owners. And one of the things we do is sort of help business owners identify where they need access to credit and sort of create relationships with them and bankers and specifically community development lenders, because that's a big piece.
And I signed up for the workshop starting next week, okay. So yeah. Okay.
On a sunny Thursday, Fountain meets with Tamika Edwards, a new client with plans to grow her online crafting supplies business. She hands Fountain a business plan.
So basically the reason why I wanted to come in today is just wanted to get your feedback on my plan and
Okay. So tell me about your business, business idea, or your business, the existing business.
Right now, I'm
Tamika Edwards is a Bayview native with a wealth of business ideas, but not much access to capital. When she lost her job at a large crafting supply store, Edwards decided to start her own online venture. She's considering a microloan for the $30,000 she needs to build inventory and grow her business. Edwards says the support from Renaissance will help take her business to the next level.
It takes a village. Like, you can't do anything by yourself. I feel you need support. So I'm really happy that there's opportunities like this, not only in San Francisco, but in the Bayview.
Bayview residents like Edwards and Ball have defied the challenges afflicting their neighbors in a community that has been marginalized, according to Robin Fountain.
If you don't have education or you've been to prison, it's like nearly impossible to have access to formal employment, specifically the kind of formal employment that would enables you to support a family. And so a lot of the time, entrepreneurship is the only way for people to sort of lift themselves out of poverty.
Small businesses are vital for generating employment in the community. Renaissance Entrepreneurship Center found that, on average, 3 jobs were created by each business they assisted, in addition to full-time employment for the owner. Nonprofits aren't the only ones trying to give a leg up to small business owners in this economy. Through the Small Business Association, or SBA, the federal government offers ARC loans as part of the stimulus dollars to business owners in trouble. But Fountain says the program hasn't been as attainable as her clients think.
Clients come in and they say, oh my gosh, the Obama administration is giving thousands of dollars to business owners. And it's like, not really. Just the way that that's worked is that the SBA decided these things are so special that we have these ridiculous requirements that nobody can meet. So sort of nobody really has access to those ARC loans, unfortunately.
While the ARC loans are modest, microenterprises don't usually meet the criteria. Small businesses seeking ARC loans must have posted profits and then suffered a setback. While Renaissance provides support and resources for startups, they don't provide capital. They refer out to microlenders, known as Community Development Financial Institutions, or CDFIs. Eric Weaver, CEO of Opportunity Fund, heads up one of the leading CDFIs in the U.S. He started Opportunity Fund in 1992 when the Clinton administration began to enforce a law encouraging banks to make loans in redlined communities. Weaver saw a chance to reach out to the underserved. That's why, as a microlender, they take character into account, not just a credit score.
In general, you're going to find often a reluctance to engage with traditional financial institutions, which could have to do with immigration status, it could have to do with language barriers, it could have to do with past experience that have been humiliating. So we want to provide opportunity to people who deserve it and haven't had it, and we think that's wrong.
Since the economic crisis put a freeze on credit, even bankable entrepreneurs have been denied loans. In 2009, Kiva, a key player in microlending abroad, started supporting small businesses in the U.S. They partnered with Opportunity Fund and another CDFI, Acción USA.
We didn't know anything about international microfinance, but we just started doing it, and we had the same experience that people had had overseas. You know, the money got paid back, and by and large, I mean, we have about a 90% repayment rate, and people's lives improved.
Many of the businesses financed by Opportunity Fund provide basic services to their communities. They're truckers, house cleaners, and caterers, providers of health care and child care. It's not the sexy high-tech industry associated with the San Francisco Bay Area, but these businesses play a vital role.
You can't have engineers, you know, inventing new software or faster chips if they don't have a place for their children to go while they work.
Weaver says these businesses are the backbone of the economy, and their backers, such as Opportunity Fund, are scaling up their microlending to meet the increased demand. Dante Ball recalls President Obama's focus on small business in his speeches.
He's talked about small business owners and how if the country was to get out of a recession and turn around, it's up to us to really push that. And you know, this country is founded on small business.
It's risky to start a small business in these times, and not everyone will see their business grow as Ball has. And yet, the support for microenterprise that we're seeing on the local level has tremendous impacts on the health of the U.S. economy as a whole. For Making Contact, I'm Lee Miao Levitt.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, the show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to How We Survive, Getting Creative About Jobs.
When there aren't enough hours of work to go around, why not share them? That's the premise of shared work programs in 17 states around the country. Instead of laying a few people off during a downturn in business, companies can choose to decrease the hours of all of their employees, and government-provided partial unemployment benefits can help make up the rest. Correspondent Melinda Tuhus explores how the program works in Connecticut.
When Dan Ringrose got word in the spring of 2010 that he could get furloughed 1 or 2 days a week at his job as an installer at Lincoln Door in Rocky Hill, Connecticut, he wasn't exactly thrilled.
I wasn't sure what it was about. I've never been laid off or anything like that. And you hear neighbors and friends being laid off. And then they said it was only 1 day a week, so hope for the best.
Business was slow at Lincoln Door, which installs commercial and residential overhead doors. The company had to cut payroll, but instead of laying off workers, management decided to cut back hours and spare jobs. They used a state program called Shared Work, which allows employees to collect unemployment benefits for furloughed time. In the end, Ringrose works one less day a week, loses only half a day's pay, and keeps all his benefits.
It's good in a way that I'm still getting paid at least for half of that, you know, for that day, so you can still pay the bills. A little tighter, but it's good to get a little back from everything, you know, been putting in all the taxes and stuff over the years. So.
Ringrose works for one of over 500 companies participating in workshare programs in Connecticut. At Lincoln Door, workers' days off are staggered. Ringrose is using his days off to get things done around the house and spend time with his two children. His wife works a full-time job, but it's not a vacation for him, he says.
I'd rather not be in a situation. You know, I can work.
When the Great Recession hit the American workforce, some states were better prepared to weather the storm. 17 of them already had shared work programs in place, some since the 1970s. Connecticut didn't get on board until the early 1990s. Neil Rowan of the Connecticut Department of Labor says they borrowed best practices from several surrounding states.
What I've done with the program since I've been charged with it since 1995, tried to make it as flexible as possible for the employers. So it's, you know, if it helps them, as long as it's in the framework of the regulations, you know, we'll allow them to do certain things.
Rowan says the number of participating companies increased tenfold between 2008 and 2009, covering some 20,000 workers. By mid-2010, that number deflated, but the program is still strong, says Rowan.
Employers actually have a free hand as to how they schedule their employees' time off. Most of them want to do it in the 1 8-hour workday increment, but it's not required that they do so. Like what I always advise employers, scheduling the employees' time off is totally dependent on their operating needs and demands. They might need the people, the employees come in 5 days a week, but working like 6 hours a day or something like that. A lot of them try to do it on Monday or Friday, give the employees a long weekend. They can shut down their location and save on utilities.
Rowan tries to get the word out about the program in different ways, but he's sure there are companies out there that still don't know it exists. What do unions think of the idea? Rowan responds by snapping his fingers.
Most companies that have unions, they sign off on the application in a minute. Generally, it really is a win-win for the employers and the employees. I mean, especially for the employers that want to maintain their employees, that they spent a lot of time training them, educating them, and have seniority, and they don't want to lose those employee skills. I mean, that's the ultimate goal of the program, is employee retention.
Rowan acknowledges what he considers minor drawbacks to the program. One is the paperwork, though he says the application is easy to navigate. The other downside is that it might raise a company's unemployment compensation tax rate. Lincoln Door shares a cavernous plant with its sister company, Hartford Technologies. Pat Stachin is the human resources administrator for both companies. Hartford Technologies makes ball bearings for everything from cars to lip gloss.
Anything that rolls, there's ball bearings in it.
Stachin says in early 2009, the company suffered a 40% drop in orders as customers, hit by the recession, used up their inventories. So Hartford Technologies union employees began getting Fridays off that March, with all management employees following in April on staggered days off. For administrators like herself, that was a challenge.
Even though we were on a 4-day work week, we still had the same 5 days of work. So you had to step it up a little bit, and you had to get what you needed to get done. The pluses were you enjoyed the springtime and the summer, and those little added projects that you had at home got done. Everyone was in it. Everyone saw the turndown of the business. And it just made everybody work together as a team, I think, more. And the fact that they felt that the company was doing something for them other than just saying, hey, we don't have the work for you. We need to lay you off.
An employee named Roland with 50 years' experience is running the stamping machine that shoots out the bearings. Kevin Newcomb handles shipping for the company and is the union rep for United Auto Workers Local 367, which represents production workers. In his small office off the production floor, he explains how the steel balls get into a bearing.
There's a plastic brace holding the balls, and on that machine that Roland's working on over there.
Newcomb shares Stachin's enthusiasm for the shared work program. He says he never got any complaints from his workers about the day off and loss of a half a day's pay.
Well, I liked the idea of it. At least nobody got laid off. And we did talk about it when we had the contract negotiations. Oh, I loved it. I spent a lot of time with my grandson. Oh, yeah. I liked the time off.
A bill, the Keep Americans Working Act, was introduced last year in Congress by Connecticut Representative Rosa DeLauro and Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, a state with one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation. DeLauro says the Connecticut program works well, and she says her federal bill could actually save the government money by paying workers to keep working.
It really is an unbelievable, I think, model. You know, workers in the, 33 states and are without these benefits. So this is about thousands of jobs. This is, an opportunity to expand the workshare programs that are already in the 17 states. It standardizes the program, provides protection for employers, employees, you know, sets up funds for states to create their own programs. You know, we're hopeful that other states are, you know, going to involve themselves in this effort. It's a temporary federal financing of 100% of the benefits paid to workers for up to 26 weeks. So, you know, we would guarantee that that money would be available, you know, during this period of time.
Meanwhile, after a full year on furlough, business began picking up at Hartford Technologies, and workers went back to full time in March 2010. Pat Stachan says she expects Lincoln Door to be on the program for 6 months at the most. For Making Contact, I'm Melinda Tuhus.
Earlier in our show, we heard from Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's also the author of False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and has written extensively about shared work programs. We got him on the phone from Washington.
Dean Baker, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So we just heard a story of how workers at a company in Connecticut were all furloughed as a way to prevent an alternative scenario of mass layoffs. Could you talk about some other types of work-sharing scenarios and how many companies and workers are already doing this type of thing right now?
Well, the basic story here is that you give companies an incentive to reduce the work week or average number of hours per worker and keep people employed rather than just lay them off and have them go on unemployment. And this is done, we have 17 states that have work-share programs tied into the unemployment compensation system. But it's done on a much larger scale in several European countries. In Germany, it's been an enormous success. The unemployment rate today is actually lower than it was when their recession started, even though the recession's been more severe than the one in the U.S. And the standard package there's differences, but the standard package is that workers have a 20% reduction in hours. The government makes up 60% of that, paying 12% of total pay. They ask the companies to kick in 20% of the lost pay, or in other words, 4% of total pay. And then the worker ends up taking home 4% less money. So they're working 20% fewer hours. That might typically mean a four-day work week instead of a five-day work week. And they're taking home 4% less pay. So they end up not being badly hurt. In some cases, if you look at the costs, work-related costs, commuting, they may actually come out ahead in the story.
And what kind of industries are doing this type of arrangement? The companies in Connecticut were in the manufacturing industry. Is that typical? Is this cross-sector?
Disproportionately, it is done in manufacturing. And in several states, they have a requirement that it could only be done by firms that employ more than 50. And those people tend to be disproportionately manufacturing. Obviously, there are non-manufacturing firms that employ more than 50. And some manufacturing firms don't have 50 workers. But disproportionately, the bigger firms are in manufacturing. And the logic here is that you're more likely to have workers that are working on a fixed schedule, say a punch clock, and to some extent are doing sort of the same type of work. So it's harder to talk about sort of this work-sharing arrangement if you envision a smaller employer, say they have 7 or 8 workers, and they're all doing different work. It might be hard to work on an arrangement where you just cut back hours. Not to say impossible, but it might be harder to do.
And what about the unions? I'm wondering how they feel about these arrangements. Are there concerns about seniority or expectations for increased production in fewer hours of work?
There is some concern. I mean, because we've talked with some unions about this, and you know, the workshare programs that are in place date back from the late 70s, and they tried to make sure that workers' rights were protected in the programs that are on the books in the 17 states that have them. But some of the unions, I know, for example, the Service Employees International Union, which is the largest single union in the country, they're very supportive of it. So I think in general, unions are open to the idea. They'd want to make sure it was implemented in such a way that it didn't interfere with union contracts. But there's no reason in principle that can't be the case. And of course, in the countries in Europe that have gone this route, they're very heavily unionized. So Germany and the Netherlands have a much higher unionization rate than the United States. So, you know, obviously their unions have been able to work with it quite successfully.
You mentioned 17 states. Why only 17? I mean, this is paying workers to stay employed instead of paying them to be unemployed. You think this would kind of be a no-brainer. How come only 17 states are participating?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, to me, it seems like a no-brainer. It seems everyone benefits. I mean, the companies, certainly, they're better situated for the expansion, having the people on staff. Workers, you know, I think in the vast majority of cases, they'd certainly rather be working shorter hours than laid off. I understand they don't all get laid off, but, you know, they all face that risk. I think you know, inertia, having been in Washington for almost two decades, I think inertia is about the most powerful force in policy. And, you know, you raise a new idea and people kind of scratch their head and go, well, that might be a good idea. But it really takes some pressure to change things. So I think over time we probably will move that way. You know, when you see Germany, you know, here we have double-digit unemployment. There they have shorter work weeks and longer vacations. You'd think people would say maybe we should do things differently here. And I think over time they will, but Washington changes slowly.
And there is a federal bill encouraging work-sharing programs. What would happen if it passed? Would it be, do you think it would be the answer, or at least a big part of the answer to the current unemployment and economic problems?
Well, I should point out there are two different bills. There's one, or two types of bills. One, which there's a comparable bill in both the House and Senate, basically give extra money to the 17 states that already have it to run their program and make seed money available for the other 33 states that don't have it. The other bill tries to do this as a tax credit. It was put up by John Conyers. Essentially would allow businesses to take advantage of it through the federal level without going through the state unemployment system. That, I think, in principle is the more desirable way to go because it could have an effect much more quickly. The first bills that I was talking about have more support, more chance of passage, but they wouldn't accomplish as much. The second bill, if you can get through some sort of tax credit for this, could in principle have an effect very, very quickly, a big effect, I should say, very quickly.
And do you have other ideas or proposals? You probably have quite a few for solving unemployment problems in the U.S., especially long-term unemployment?
Well, we're in an extraordinary situation here. We, you know, thankfully haven't been in this situation since the Depression, but we really have to, I think, look to do things we might not otherwise do. And when you look at sort of the pockets of unemployment you have in a place like Detroit, some of the other really hard-hit areas, I think in those areas it makes sense just to have public sector jobs. And, you know, people will deride these as make-work jobs, and they may well be to a large extent, but the point is, you look at Detroit, you have somewhere around 50% youth unemployment. Those people aren't going to get jobs, so we either do something fairly drastic, or we just tell a whole generation of kids that, you know, well, you're born in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I don't think that's a reasonable solution. I mean, it wasn't their fault that they were born in Detroit when we got hit with this downturn. So I would say, at least in some areas, we certainly want to have public sector jobs to get people, give them something to do, give them a paycheck, give them a start in life. Some other things, we do have infrastructure needs. The Obama administration has made some steps that way, but I think there's a lot more. There's a big backlog of infrastructure. The concern when they put up their stimulus originally back in the winter of 2009 was we couldn't do it quickly enough. Well, better or worse, we're going to be in this for a long time. That's what all the projections show. So if we're doing infrastructure projects that aren't going to kick in until 2012, 2013, we'll probably still need the spending then. So we should address our infrastructure needs. So I'd say that should be another priority. But the long and short, I think the best way to deal with unemployment is this work share idea. Let's allow people to work fewer hours, and I think that takes care of the immediate problem. But we do have the separate issue that we have pockets of really hardcore unemployment, and then also let's take advantage of this downturn in the sense that we've neglected infrastructure in many ways. So why not take advantage of this downturn to try to address that neglect?
Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's also the author of Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy, and False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy. Dean Baker, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure, thanks a lot for having me on.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or check out our website at radioproject.org. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.